stock markets in turmoil with fears of the coronavirus. Investors are worried about disruptions to global supply chains. American cars are dependent on them.
Some of the first calls I got in the beginning days of this outbreak were, well, what do we get from China? Well, we get everything from China.
Also today, Egyptian President Hosni Mubarak has died. We look back at his troubling legacy.
I saw for the first time how a dictator is totally prepared to kill hundreds of people to keep power.
And London has a problem. When you've really got to go, where are the free toilets?
Not everybody can afford to spend £3 on a coffee just to get the code for a toilet door somewhere in a cafe.
I'm Marco Werman. Those stories and more today here on The World. I'm Marco Werman. You're with The World. It's not a question of if, but when. That's the prediction today from the Centers for Disease Control and Prevention that the coronavirus will spread to the U.S. Dr. Nancy Messonnier directs the National Center for Immunization and Respiratory Diseases.
We are asking the American public to work with us to prepare in the expectation that this could be bad. I continue to hope that in the end we'll look back and feel like we are overprepared, but that is a better place to be in than being underprepared.
Messonnier said people should be making contingency plans at home, at work, and at school in case the virus spreads here. Iran is already dealing with an outbreak. The deputy health minister himself has been infected by the coronavirus. Iraj Harirchi posted a video from quarantine. The coronavirus is democratic, he said, trying to keep things light. It affects anybody and everybody. Harirchi promised, though, that Iran will overcome these tough times. Iranians we spoke with, though, are skeptical about the way their leaders have been dealing with the outbreak so far. Here's The World's Shirin Jafari.
Mariam is a 25-year-old student in Tehran. As part of her studies, she works at several different hospitals. A few weeks ago, she says she noticed something unusual. More and more people were showing up with flu-like symptoms, says Mariam. She asked me not to use her full name because she fears retaliation from the government. At that time, no coronavirus cases had been detected in Iran. So the doctors diagnosed the patients with the flu and they sent them home. Things changed last week. For the first time, Iranian officials admitted that a handful of people had died from COVID-19. The epicenter was Qom, a city near Tehran. At this point, Mariam, the medical student, says one hospital where she works at scrambled to set up a quarantine section. She says several patients are critically ill. At least one person has died, a 51-year-old man. Mariam tells me there is a serious shortage of test kits. Only a few hospitals across the country have them, and she thinks she might have been infected too. She has some of the symptoms, but can't get tested because there aren't enough kits. Mariam says the country was not prepared for this kind of outbreak. Iran has a lot of trade and other connections with China. But up until last week, Iranian officials were telling the public that the coronavirus had not reached Iran. They even sent more than 50,000 respiratory masks to China. Iranians I talked to say there is now a shortage, not only of masks, but also hand sanitizers and antibacterial wipes. 31-year-old Omid Shukuhi is a tour guide and translator in Tehran. He says he has lost trust in the government. Shukuhi decided to quarantine himself at his apartment just to be safe. He only goes out for quick grocery runs. He says he reads a lot of foreign news coverage about the virus, and he found this video from the World Health Organization helpful. It's got Farsi subtitles.
Frequently clean your hands by using an alcohol-based hand rub product like a gel.
Iranian social media is now full of tips and information about how people can take care of themselves and what to do if they get sick. A group of fitness trainers in Tehran started this campaign on Instagram. They're telling people not to shake hands or kiss one another on the cheeks, as it's common in Iran. A group of medical professionals are on social media too, offering to answer questions. People are asking questions like, what do I do if I'm diabetic? Should I wear a mask? How long are the masks good for? Vahid Rajablu says these are tough times for people with disabilities. Rajablu is a 32-year-old business owner in Tehran. His company connects people with disabilities to other businesses like hair salons and so on. Rajablu told his 22 employees to work from home. He says his business was already struggling financially before the outbreak. Now it's going to get even worse. But I have a civic duty, he tells me. I don't want my employees to get sick. We all have to be patient right now. A team from the WHO has arrived in Iran to assist the government in its response to the outbreak. And that assistance is sorely needed. The Persian New Year is about a month away. The challenge will be to get the coronavirus under control before then, because that's when many Iranians travel and visit family. For the world, I'm Shirin Jafari.
Later in the show, we'll look at whether shutting down borders is an effective way to stop a virus from spreading. In other news, former Egyptian President Hosni Mubarak died today. He was 91. The autocrat ruled his country for 30 years. But how it all ended is what people may remember most. January 2011, Tahrir Square in Cairo. Hundreds of thousands of Egyptians rose up and forced Mubarak from power during the heady days of the Arab Spring. He was later put on trial for the killing of more than 850 protesters by security forces in the final days of his regime. Mubarak was found guilty only of fraud and avoided serving jail time. Nancy O'Kale is an Egyptian activist and scholar, now in exile in the United States. She is still proud of what the protesters achieved.
If it was not actually for the perseverance of protesters relentlessly demonstrating in the square every Friday, Mubarak would have not been put on trial and would have spent the rest of his days in his mansion in Sharm el-Sheikh.
Egypt's revolution against Mubarak was a bittersweet victory for many, Alaa al-Aswani included. He's one of Egypt's most prominent novelists and was also forced into exile. Aswani says history won't be kind to Mubarak.
He was a corrupt dictator and he was a criminal because he ordered the killing of the protesters in 2011. But all his crimes were covered by his generals.
So protesters in 2011 wanted democracy and they wanted Mubarak out. You were one of those protesters. You were out there almost every day. You were seeing protesters getting shot to your left, to your right. What were you thinking? How were you reflecting about the Mubarak years out there in the streets?
Well, that was a turning point in my life because they send snipers everywhere and you just see the people falling dead around you. And I will never forget this. That's why I cannot go back to Egypt anymore. I wrote the word people many times in my novels, but the first time I learned what is the meaning of the people was in Tahrir Square. You live with 1 million people as if we were one single family. We eat together, we drink together, we sing together, and we die together. Second, I saw for the first time how a dictator is totally prepared to kill hundreds of people to keep power. This is unbelievable. You see, before I read that in history, but the first time I found myself face to face with this miserable fact is that the dictator is capable to kill just to keep power.
So last year, military prosecutors in Egypt sued you for insulting the president. That would be Abdel Fattah al-Sisi. With Sisi in power, some say his control over Egypt is even tighter than Mubarak. What do you think the path is back to what people were protesting for in 2011?
No, we have a much worse version of the regime, because usually in history, when you revolt against a dictator or a regime and you don't remove it totally, then the regime becomes something like a wounded tiger. And the wounded tiger is much, much more dangerous. It will attack everybody just to make sure that this will never happen again. And that's exactly what's happening in Egypt. We have a wounded tiger in power.
Alaa Alaswani, did you ever admire Mubarak? Was there a point when he gave you hope for the future of Egypt?
I learned history enough to be against any dictator. This is not the case of many Egyptians. So we have Egyptians who think that a dictator, yes, he's a dictator, but he's doing something good. You know, I don't think this way. Dictators are not always failures. They could do achievements in the beginning, but the rule of history that any dictator will end up by a catastrophic situation.
Given the strong arm of al-Sisi, was the ouster of Mubarak really much of an accomplishment?
When you make a revolution, you never achieve what you want overnight, because it's simply impossible. You have your courage as a revolutionary, you have your conscience, you're willing to die for freedom. And on the other side, you have an old regime which is having everything. They have the media, they have the army, they have the police, they have everything. So it takes time. We just need time. But the future is on our side.
Alaa Alaswani, the author of The Yacoubian Building, which followed the lives of Cairo residents struggling under the dictatorship of Hosni Mubarak. Thank you very much for being with us today.
Thank you, sir.
Everyone's been there. You're out and about, and suddenly you have to go, like now. But finding a well-maintained and free public restroom is not always easy. In London, a Twitter feed is trying to change that. A group is collecting and distributing access codes for restrooms around the city. They're called London Loo Codes, you know, loo being short for the John in England. Sophie Bowley Aiken is one of the founders of London Loo Codes.
In London, we have very few public toilets. A lot of them have been closed down. So between 2006 and 2016, we lost 1,782 public toilets because of budget cuts to local councils, which have meant that as they've had to make increasingly difficult decisions about where funds are allocated, public toilets have been one of the things to go.
And why is it important to you that restrooms be available for free?
I'm a young, able-bodied person, and if push comes to shove, I can afford to buy a coffee if I need to use the loo, which I frequently do. But, you know, not everybody's able to do that. There are people with chronic health conditions, or people with kids, or people who are older or pregnant, or people who are sleeping rough who need access to a loo, and there's nowhere for them to go. Not everybody can afford to spend £3 on a coffee just to get the code for a toilet door somewhere in a cafe.
So this is obviously a good thing for people who are, you know, crossing their legs and got to go real bad. Have you gotten any negative feedback, though, from, say, the shop owners where these facilities are?
There hasn't been any explicit pushback. Nobody's contacted us directly. However, we have noticed that a lot of these chains are changing the codes more and more regularly. So there is being pushback in that respect, yeah.
Are there any policy solutions that London Loo Codes is calling for? Like, what would you like the City of London to do right now about public facilities?
We would love to see more provision in London for public loos, but we would also really like the larger chains that kind of populate our high streets in London to take the codes off the doors as well. We think it would be just a really great way for them to increase footfall and to show kind of what they're about and the role that they want to play in our society.
I mean, the fact that if you can afford a $5 latte, you get access to a toilet. If you can't afford it, you're on your own. What does all this tell us about where British society is at today?
I think it tells us that increasingly to participate in society, you have to have money to do it. And, you know, especially with Brexit having just happened, there's been a lot of publicity in London about how London is open and everybody is welcome. But the lack of toilets or just spaces to exist without spending money says to me that London is only open if you have money to spend.
Sophie Bowley Aiken, the co-founder of London Loo Codes, speaking with us from London. Sophie, thank you very much.
Thank you so much for having me on.
You're listening to The World. I'm Marco Werman. It's The World. Bernie Sanders is leading the pack of Democratic presidential candidates, thanks in part to some strong support from Latinos in Nevada last weekend. It's a good sign for Sanders. Latinos are a critical voting bloc. Roughly every 30 seconds, a Latino in the United States turns 18 and becomes eligible to vote. This year, we're following the stories of this group of potential new Latino voters. Today, we meet a young woman in Arizona. Michelle Marisco from KJZZ in Phoenix has her story.
Adela Diaz is ready for the upcoming election. She's 18 and a freshman at the University of Arizona in Tucson, where she studies public health. Adela is also a registered Democrat, and she has her key issues in focus.
Healthcare and access to healthcare is something that I care a lot about.
Adela is following the candidates and their positions.
Hearing some good plans for, you know, Medicare for all in 3 years. And something that Elizabeth Warren brought up in the February 7th debate that I really liked was she said that she was going to work on getting the most common prescription drugs to be more affordable to the average American, which is really important to me.
Adela is the kind of voter who will watch the Democratic debates while on the phone with her dad, George Diaz. He lives 150 miles away in the Phoenix area.
Hi, son.
Hi.
The two catch up as they normally do, but with Adela and her dad, the conversation turns to politics. President Trump was just in Phoenix.
So did you listen to any of it? Did you read any articles about it at all?
I read about it a little bit.
Yeah.
This year, people like Adela Diaz are projected to be an increasingly essential voting group. In Arizona, Latinos make up about a third of the population and about a fourth of the electorate. In 2018, they helped flip a contested U.S. Senate seat in Arizona from red to blue. So campaigns are targeting voters like Adela on college campuses.
Hello, guys. Are you guys registered to vote here in Arizona?
Yes, sir.
Adela hears us all the time outside her student union at the University of Arizona, where she spends most of her time studying. That keeps her busy.
I've always just tried my hardest to do it all, like, I was a two-sport varsity athlete. I was in National Honor Society, Spanish Honor Society. I was officers in all my clubs. And that's just kind of how I grew up. That's like the entire scope of my life.
Adela is third-gen Mexican-American. She grew up in a Phoenix neighborhood where she felt safe going for a run. Her parents and brother still live in the same house she grew up in. George, her dad, is a lobbyist for the city of Buckeye, a Phoenix suburb.
While she represents the awareness among young people, she also does not have that sense of activism. Her sense of activism is, I'm going to get educated and I'm going to have a professional career that allows me to help people.
George doesn't lecture his daughter about the issues affecting her generation. She's well aware of the challenges she faces as a Gen Z. It
goes far beyond those policies that people typically associate with Latinos, right? Immigration, dreamers, that kind of thing. Of course, those are important, but it goes way beyond that. Tell me how I'm going to pay less for college tuition. Tell me how I can be assured that I'm going to have a job when I get out of school. Those kinds of things.
Adela Diaz hasn't decided what she'll use her public health degree for when she graduates, but she worries about how the current healthcare system excludes so many people, and it's shaping her opinion of the candidates.
As of now, I think Elizabeth Warren may be my favorite. I like her Medicare for All in 3 years plan, as I've briefly heard it in the debates.
As a first-time voter, Adela is excited to cast her ballot next month in the Democratic primary race. She'll get that opportunity on March 17th. For The World, I'm Michel Marisco in Arizona.
Learn more about the young Latinos who could swing the 2020 election. Check us out at theworld.org/every30seconds. That's 30 seconds. The Dow Jones Industrial Average had another big drop today, closing down 3.15%. That's on top of yesterday's 3.5% drop. Markets hate uncertainty, and right now uncertainty is high because no one knows how bad the coronavirus outbreak could get and how it could impact global supply chains or consumer demand. Let's look at one industry, automobiles. Kristen Jicek is vice president of business at the Center for Automotive Research in Ann Arbor, Michigan.
Some of the first calls I got in the beginning days of this outbreak were, well, what do we get from China? Well, we get everything from China, and it doesn't even matter if the United States bought any auto parts from China. We buy auto parts from other countries that most certainly have Chinese content embedded in them. That center in Wuhan, you know, makes brakes and brake pads, small electronics and electrical lighting. You know, there's just a whole bunch of stuff that gets made in China that is then embedded into larger products that we may be buying from Japan or South Korea or even Mexico.
And what happens when those parts, those circuit boards, run out? I mean, is a factory in another part of the world, is a factory in the United States, they just can't complete the car?
Depending on what the parts, the missing parts are, then yes, there could be, you know, you need all of the parts to make a car usually. You know, one of the disruptions that we heard about was that there may be some, one automaker had through social media channels had said, not the automaker themselves, but somebody had mentioned, well, we're not going to be able to get these decals. I'm like, well, decals, you can put those vehicles out in a lot, wait for the decals to come. But these disruptions that are happening now, I mean, we're not exactly sure when that will impact the automakers here.
And as we look ahead to the possible future spread of the virus, what do you do if a significant portion of your factory workers are out sick?
You know, and it's not something you can do from home. You know, like, I know that work from home policy is something that a lot of people can do, but, you know, somebody assembling a vehicle or assembling parts and components for automotive manufacturing cannot do that from home. So, yeah, we would see production disruptions, absolutely, with the workforce if that were to play out here in North America. But certainly that's what we're seeing in China and in South Korea, Japan a little bit, and then on to northern Italy.
What about consumer confidence?
Absolutely. I think, you know, consumer confidence is, you know, a difficult thing to judge how they're going to view this. And, you know, consumers in China, for instance, you know, after the SARS epidemic, we did see a spike in automotive demand as more folks who had means decided they didn't want to ride public transit and be exposed to viruses and instead would prefer to travel in a private car. So, you know, there could be a strong rebound on the other side of it. And, you know, we don't really know how demand is going to come back after this long of a disruption.
So, Kristen, it sounds like the industry is not freaking out, but it's watching the situation very carefully.
They're watching, they're making plans, and there's a lot of work to be had in figuring out how to rejigger the supply chain and keep those factories that are making products that people want here, keep those running and keep the jobs going. It's a potential several weeks down the road that we may start to see the disruptions here, and it could be extremely disruptive if they don't manage these plans and these strategies well. And I think that's partly why we see them keeping these plans very close to the vest, that, you know, it's a strategic advantage for a company that can figure out how to keep their production running.
Kristen Jicek at the Center for Automotive Research in Ann Arbor, Michigan. Thank you.
Thank you, Marco.
News headlines are just ahead. You're with the world. The coronavirus is quickly crossing international borders, and some governments are increasing travel restrictions. But is shutting down borders the right course of action?
I'm uncomfortable in general with highly restrictive policies because, in our experience, they just don't work.
Containing a virus by curtailing travel. That's coming up here on The World. I'm Marco Werman. You're with The World. We're a co-production of the BBC World Service, WGBH Boston, and PRX. It was a quick one. President Trump left India today after a whirlwind two-day visit. There was rioting between Hindus and Muslims in Delhi while Trump was there. At least a dozen people have been killed and hundreds injured. The violence comes amid growing reports of human rights violations and attacks on religious minorities in India. President Trump said he spoke with Prime Minister Narendra Modi about this.
We did talk about religious freedom, and I will say that the Prime Minister was incredible on what he told me. He wants people to have religious freedom, and very strongly, and he said that in India, they have worked very hard to have great and open religious freedom.
President Trump seems to take Modi at his word, and he isn't the only American who's done so. Here's The World's Rupa Shenoy with more on that.
A few weeks ago, I was in Iowa for the caucuses, talking to young climate activists at my former high school in Cedar Rapids. I asked one of them, a daughter of Indian immigrants named Isha Kalia, what she thought of Indian Prime Minister Narendra Modi.
I don't really follow Indian politics very much, but I obviously hear what my parents are saying. So my parents, like, are supporters of Modi, and all I've really heard is, oh, Modi's doing great things. He's getting rid of corruption in India. He's, like, building the country up again.
She had heard about a new Indian law that helps some religious minorities become citizens, but not Muslims. Isha asked her parents about it.
They basically defended the Muslim ban, and I, at the time, was just like, okay, like, they're both Indians. They were born in India. They obviously know more than I do. Who am I to, like, get involved in this? So I was like, okay, I guess, like, Modi has his reasons for doing what he's doing.
This is a thing. Many Indian Americans identify as minorities and vote Democratic, especially under President Trump, and many of those same people are upper caste Hindus who support Trump's friend in India, Modi. They see Modi as pious and hardworking. There's a group in the U.S. that's been helping him with that image since the early 1990s.
Hello, my name is Krishna Reddy, president of Forces Friends of BJP.
The BJP, the Bharatiya Janata Party, is Modi's Hindu nationalist party.
What we do is project a correct view of BJP and what they're trying to do.
Reddy says what the BJP is trying to do is help poor people. Modi brought electricity to many villages and built thousands of toilets across the country. Reddy says he and other BJP supporters in the U.S. want to help Modi improve life in India.
So we want to see the same benefits that we have in the Western world. We want to see the same things in India.
Modi himself has appealed directly to the 18 million people worldwide who make up the Indian diaspora. They send nearly $70 billion back to India every year. Modi holds big events for them in places like Australia and the U.S.
Howdy, my friends!
Biju Matthews with India's Civil Watch, a rights monitoring group based in North America. He says Modi's connection to the Indians outside the country helps him project a strong image inside the country and advance Hindu nationalism.
A Hindu nationalism that is trying to project this golden Hindu future. One of the only images it has to draw on is the rich Indian diaspora. And so lifestyles, houses, how people live, what they do, there is this particular way in which those images become part of the imaginary of Hindu nationalism and is projected backwards into India.
But Modi couldn't hide the reality in India last summer when his government locked down Kashmir, the disputed state bordering Pakistan. Indian Americans who have long opposed Modi mobilized. People with relatives in Kashmir called their representatives. Washington State Congresswoman Pramila Jayapal, the first Indian American House member, introduced a resolution calling on the Indian government to uphold human rights. And in early February, another Indian American in Seattle, City Council member Kashama Sawant, introduced a resolution condemning the new Indian law leaving Muslims out from a pathway to citizenship. Many supporters and opponents showed up, and the hearing got testy.
The room will be cleared, or individuals will be asked to leave. Is there security present?
Krishna Reddy of the BJP in America group says those in the U.S. criticizing Modi don't really understand the situation in India. He says Modi's main opposition, the Congress political party, is spreading misinformation among Westerners.
It's a propaganda by some Western interests to show BJP in a poor light. So whatever these people write, I mean, especially New York Times or, you know, Washington Post, I mean, they talked about Hindu fundamentalist party. There's nothing like that.
Meanwhile, back in India, some Indians are getting tired of their relatives abroad having opinions about Indian politics.
I do not like it when Indian uncles in America tell me how good Narendra Modi is for my country.
This is Bollywood star and comedian Veer Das.
I want to be cautious when I say this, but I kind of want you to leave us alone and let us do our own thing.
But Modi invited the diaspora to get involved. And now it is, all of it, including those who disagree with Modi and with his friend Trump. For The World, I'm Rupa Shenoy.
The coronavirus continues to spread, and U.S. officials want Americans to be prepared and take precautions. One big question we keep hearing from listeners, is it okay for me to travel? Several governments around the world have closed their borders or halted air travel to regions with coronavirus outbreaks. The tension between travel, disease, and politics is something Amy Pope knows well.
The leaders managing the response need to quell anxiety as opposed to stoking it. It's very important they lead with the science, they lead with the evidence, and they come up with solutions that are, again, evidence-based as opposed to just politically reactive.
That's a conclusion Amy Pope came to when she was the Deputy Homeland Security Advisor at the White House during the 2014 Ebola outbreak in West Africa. And the lessons she learned there are top of mind as she follows this new coronavirus outbreak.
I think the best course of action is to really try to separate the rhetoric from what we know about the outbreak. And the WHO has on its website an ongoing situation report. The Centers for Disease Control and Prevention in the United States also has ongoing traveling alerts about the risks associated with going to various parts of the world. And within my own workplace, we are advising our employees to check those websites regularly, but not to overreact. So, for example, the current guidance is that if you've been to Italy, but not been to one of the 10 towns that have been effectively quarantined by the Italian government, then there's no reason to self-isolate. There's no reason to stay home unless you start to develop symptoms. But ultimately, a lot of this goes back to the same precautions that we need to use when preventing the flu. Simple things like hand washing, disposing of your used tissues, not going to work if you're ill. All of that is critically important and is highlighted more so when we're in a situation like the one we're in now.
So as a former security advisor to the White House, what do you think about politically between countries when we talk about border control? Like, how do countries talk to each other around this right now when the potential for frayed nerves and insults is so high?
This is where the United States can really be a leader. This was something President Obama considered at the time of Ebola. He knew that if the United States took the extraordinary measure of shutting down all travel between West Africa and the United States, that inevitably other countries would follow and West Africa would become increasingly isolated and thereby increasingly unable to manage the outbreak of the disease. So you need courage and leadership by countries that have the evidence, that have the science, that are getting the expertise, rather than sort of everyone racing to the politically expedient decision, which is just to close down borders and shut down travel.
How much different do you see the situation in other countries? Because we're seeing places that are banning travel from Iran, for example, right now. I just saw an Italian flight that landed in Mauritius. Passengers were on lockdown. So there's a lot of this going on in very kind of sporadic places around the world.
So there are a couple of different variables here. One of the questions are, what are the health systems that are in place in the countries that we're talking about? Again, post-Ebola, we learned that there was so much work to be done between improving the health systems of various countries around the world. Basic things from monitoring cases, providing rapid response, doing the contact tracing, that kind of thing that was just missing. And so if we're talking about a country that does not yet have some of those basic metrics in place, then I do think that there are more compelling reasons for them to be careful about admitting people that they have reason to believe are infected. When we're talking about countries like the United States, like Europe, Japan, other places which have very, very well-developed healthcare systems, very well-developed infection control procedures in place, and very highly functioning governments, then it's a different matter. And those countries, again, leading by example, can actually make the situation far worse. Ultimately, we don't want to drive people who are unwell underground. We don't want to end up in a situation where people are not reporting that they might be infected. That is far more damaging to communities than it is to be transparent, to identify who's ill, to treat them appropriately, to not take overly restrictive or punitive measures against them.
Mm. In other words, you have to look at the health systems of countries before judging what might seem like harsh moves to us.
I mean, I'm uncomfortable in general with highly restrictive policies because in our experience, they just don't work. But ultimately, we need to be looking at how do we shore up the most fragile states, the states that have the least resilience in responding to these kinds of infectious disease outbreaks. The better response is not to condone their travel restrictions. The better response is to look for ways to improve their own resilience to the outbreak.
Amy Pope, a former Deputy Homeland Security Advisor to the White House during the 2014 Ebola outbreak in West Africa. Thank you very much for speaking with us.
Thank you.
There's fried rice, and then there's perfect fried rice, which, it turns out, is largely dependent on your ability to constantly move the rice around in the wok. In other words, physics. A team of researchers at Georgia Tech took videos of chefs in action, and based on what they observed, they came up with a mathematical model for the perfect wok frying technique. Serious stuff if you're into fried rice. Hung Tan Ko is a PhD student at Georgia Tech.
As a kid growing up in Taiwan, my mom always asked me to fry rice, and I was trying to mimic what the chef do in the restaurants, but it's actually very hard to catch the grains. So you're only able to move the wok back and forth, but you have to both toss all the rice while being able to catch them. So we found this is a very interesting physics question.
So break down what's actually going on as you watch these chefs making fried rice. I mean, I see that you found that the work movement cycled about 3 hertz, which is physics, and I don't really know what I'm talking about. So what does that even mean?
3 hertz is a very, very fast speed. So what that means is that the chef will have to do a toss every 0.3 seconds. So that's 3 cycles per second. And another thing that we found out that's pretty surprising was that you imagine when you toss the pancake, for example, there will be a phase when your pan is totally lifted from the stove. But in reality, when we observe them tossing the wok is, in fact, always in contact with the stove.
So the wok is never actually leaving the stove, but the chef is kind of moving it around, as you say, in a very dynamic way. If you're a chef making those movements over and over and over again, how much wear and tear is that on your arms and your wrist?
Very much, because the wok itself is around 2 kilograms and could be more. And with the 3 hertz, a very fast beat, you can imagine that the burden onto the chef's shoulder and elbow joint is very, very large.
I mean, one of the reasons I understand Asian chefs love the wok is that it gets really hot and that plays really well with the food. So with that super intense heat, how does a combination of that with the movements you've been describing influence the way the rice is cooked?
It's actually very necessary for them to toss the ingredient because, like you said, the heat is enormous. If they don't lift the ingredients off the wok every now and then, the rice grains and all other ingredients will easily get burnt. So it's almost a necessity while implementing this high heat to be able to toss the ingredients.
So once you figured out the dynamics between chef and how they manipulate the wok on the stove, did you come up with some solutions to preventing wok-related injuries?
So one thing that we're thinking about is now that we have this physics of this motion, we can presumably design exoskeleton that the chefs can wear on their arms to kind of reduce the force output from the human muscle and kind of supplement some of those force output by using machines and motors.
Fried rice is over 1,000 years old. Every Chinese restaurant seems to have their own version. What is the best way to cook it, in your opinion? How do you like your fried rice? With a lot of stuff in it or pretty basic?
Pretty basic, but I'm still inclined to go to the restaurant because in my kitchen, I would never be able to implement as much heat to the cooking process. But yeah, usually you get a very good fried rice from those stir-fry restaurants in Taiwan.
If you're not going to Taiwan, what should you be looking for in a Chinese restaurant here to kind of judge their fried rice caliber?
So I think one of the things that we'll be looking for after using a very high heat is that the grains have to be separated from each other. So no grains can stick with each other. If they do, it means that the chef are probably not using as much heat when they're cooking it.
Got it. So no clumpy rice. It's got to be separate grains.
Exactly.
Hung Tan Ko, PhD student at Georgia Tech, thank you very much.
Thank you for having me.
The coronavirus likely started at a food market that sold diverse wildlife, both dead and living animals. As China tries to contain the virus, it's also taking measures to prevent future outbreaks with a total ban on the wildlife trade across the country. The world's Anna Kusmer has our story.
China already had a ban on catching and selling rare and endangered animal species, like civets and pangolins, from the wild. This new legislation expands on that to those born in captivity. It also makes buying or selling those animals, basically anything besides livestock and fish, illegal. Hours after China's top lawmaking body approved the change on Monday, the country's state media ran an announcement on TV. It said the wildlife food industry poses a grave danger to public health.
It's really exciting news.
It's really exciting news, says Beijing Normal University conservation biologist Li Zheng.
The wildlife captive breeding for meat will be banned. This is a big progress.
Big progress. Zheng says the legal market for captive bred animals had created a space for poachers to sneak in animals from the wild. Making it illegal to buy these animals and not just sell them, the new law makes things harder for poachers. But the main goal of the new law is preventing the spread of new diseases. Experts believe the new coronavirus may have spilled over from bats, possibly to an intermediary animal, then to humans in a wild animal market in Wuhan. The conditions there are perfect for disease transfer.
And you have animals literally in cages being stacked on top of each other.
John Epstein is a disease ecologist at EcoHealth Alliance in New York. He says animals in close contact can swap viruses, which can then mutate and jump from animals to people.
So animals have an opportunity to be exposed to each other's feces or urine, which is often how viruses are shed. But also you have people handling those animals and butchering those animals.
Critics say there may be pushback to the new ban. Meat from wild animals like turtles and snakes are considered delicacies in some regions. Other animals are used in traditional medicine. And if it's effective, the ban would halt a multi-billion dollar industry.
The Chinese government spent very little time developing this new law.
Ling Xu is the director of the Beijing Office for Traffic, a wildlife trade monitoring network. She says it'll take more than a ban for this to work. The government also needs to ramp up enforcement.
I don't think they can consider all the issues in this ban, and that they needed to do more consultancy.
Ling Xu says despite the downsides, the public largely supports the change.
The lessons from the coronavirus is really, really deep for everyone here.
Disease ecologist John Epstein says he's skeptical.
The risk here is that by outright banning wildlife trade, that it will drive it underground or continue to happen in ways that are even more difficult to monitor. There may be viral spillover in the future that goes undetected for even longer because it's happening secretly.
Epstein says the ban will only work if the demand for wild animal meat goes down. To make that happen, the government has to change the culture. Chinese state TV on Monday seemed to be working that angle. Underlying the enjoyment of eating these foods is the blood and tears of wild animals, the announcer says. Giving wildlife a chance for survival will also give ourselves a chance for survival. For The World, I'm Anna Kussmer.
Plastic, wood, and glass. Three materials relevant to the two deceased men we're going to be talking about. One of them just left us. Dutch toy designer Jens Nygaard Knudsen was 78. The name may not be familiar, but Knudsen was a part of many childhoods. He was a celebrated designer at Lego for more than 30 years. The iconic Lego minifigure, that was his. Smiling faces, movable arms and legs, and interchangeable torsos, so those Lego homes would not be vacant. He brought life to those kids' brick creations. A fellow designer called Knudsen one of the unsung heroes of the toy industry. Lego Group celebrated his impact and thanked him for inspiring generations of builders. As to the wood and glass I mentioned, those have been used to encase the famous English philosopher Jeremy Bentham. He died in 1832. His body was placed in a wood display box per his wishes, but you can now see him in a glass box at University College London's Student Center. Well, you can see his stuffed, preserved body anyway, dressed in his own clothes, bolted to his own chair, peering over students as they study. Professor Philip Schofield is the director of the Bentham Project at University College London. He says Jeremy Bentham remains very well known in the UK.
He's best known as the founder of the doctrine called utilitarianism, which is the idea that what we should be doing is increasing the happiness of people as much as possible.
That's a great goal. And as for Bentham's work, you know him probably better than anyone. He used to be, well, the body anyway, used to be hidden away in a wooden box. Do you think he would be happy with this recent relocation?
I mean, I think he would be quite delighted by it. He always liked being the center of attention, and he's certainly the center of attention at the moment. For the first 20 years, the auto icon, that's Bentham's stuffed body, stayed in the house of his surgeon, Thomas Southwood Smith. The auto icon only came to University College in 1850, and it came because Southwood Smith moved to a smaller house and decided he didn't have room for his non-paying guest.
Critics have a bunch of things to say about this. They say, first of all, this is not what Bentham would have wanted. They also say it's just plain creepy. And some say he looks like a mannequin in a department store. What do you think?
I think he wanted it to be visible. It's not just a show of vanity. He didn't want to be buried because that would have meant paying a fee to a priest. And he didn't want any money to go in support of religion.
I mean, if the idea of the move was to honor his legacy and remind students of his work, why not just put up a painting?
That's a very good point. And Bentham sort of thought of that. In his later life, he was very much a Democrat and believed in openness and publicity. In a sense, the new box, which is glass, and he's very visible there. It's sort of a metaphor for his own thinking on politics and government. When I went to have a look at him in his new box, the students just sort of sat around, as they always are, with their heads down in their computers, working away. It's like, you know, business as normal. As you said earlier, it's rather like a mannequin and not particularly threatening.
Professor Philip Schofield, the director of the Bentham Project at University College London, thanks for telling us about the late Jeremy Bentham in this glass case and the student union. It's a wild story.
Thank you.
If you're curious about what it looks like to put a preserved body in a student center lobby, photos of Jeremy Bentham's new location are on our Instagram. We're at PRI The World. And that is where we end things today. From the Nan and Bill Harris studio at WGBH in Boston, I'm Marco Werman. Back with you tomorrow.
The World is a co-production of WGBH Boston, the BBC World Service, and PRX.